You are listening to a sermon by Thomas Bergen, recorded on Sunday, October 16, 2016, at the Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, it's good to be back with all of you again. I feel like it's been quite a few months, so I'm looking forward to sharing the parable of the prodigal sons, which is one of my favorites, one that keeps having greater depth and greater meaning as I look more and more into it. So for the longest time, I viewed the parables with some kind of suspicion. You know, like Jesus' real teaching is in the Sermon on the Mount, but the parables, kind of second order, that was kind of my thought. And I figured that if Jesus was trying to make a theological point, he should do so in clear speech and language. What's this business with the parables? Well, I think being wiser than Jesus is not that wise, in fact. And what linguists tell us is that our parables and stories really are the building blocks of our imaginations and our thoughts. The stories we tell, the metaphors we use, they give us this scaffolding in our imagination to think about the world. They both inspire and constrain the extent to which we can do that. So in speaking in parables, Jesus isn't obscuring his point. He's really inviting us into like thinking about the world the way he sees it, and to think about it in terms of his kingdom. So that brings us to our parable today. And in this parable, Jesus offers us a way to understand ourselves and our relationship to God in these words and images familiar to us all: home, siblings, feasting, eating, a journey. And together with the parable of the Good Samaritan, this parable is probably the best known in the whole Bible. In fact, people who don't know anything at all about the Bible still know this story. From Augustine's Confession to Newton's Amazing Grace, the influence of this parable on the Christian tradition and imagination is vast. Tim Keller calls this parable the gospel within the gospel. My first introduction to this parable was in elementary school. Our school was doing a drama on this parable, and in the scene where the prodigal son longs to eat the food that the pigs are eating, I played the important role of the pigs. I didn't have any lines, but I remember thinking that my oinking sound effects made a very important contribution. Let's just say my understanding and appreciation of this parable has grown. And that's my hope for you too, that your understanding and appreciation will grow today. So this Sunday we're going to focus on the self-portrait that the characters of the younger and elder son give us. And then next month, we're going to look at this parable again, and we're going to focus more on the God portrait. So this week, self-portrait. Next month, God portrait. Even though this parable is so familiar, I think you'll be amazed at all there is to see in it. Now, you may have noticed something a bit strange in the title. Usually, we think of this parable as the lost son, singular, or the prodigal son, singular. I'm calling it the parable of the prodigal sons, plural. And that's because of the context in which Jesus tells this parable. Together with the parable of the lost sheep and coin, Jesus tells this parable in response to the criticism of the Pharisees. In Luke 15, 1-2, we read, "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and teachers of the law muttered, 'This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.'" So Jesus answers that criticism through telling this parable. And he basically explains through the parable that the reason he's eating these celebratory meals with sinners is that he's enacting God's welcome to sinners. To a prodigal nation of Israel, and we were reading about that prodigal nation in the Ezekiel passage, to that nation that's been in the distant country of exile because of its sins, Jesus announces the end of exile, the forgiveness of sins, the coming of the kingdom of God. But Jesus' good news announcement is also bad news. By refusing to enter into Jesus' celebratory meals with sinners, the Pharisees are turning away from the good news that Jesus brings to Israel. By separating themselves from Jesus' feasts, the Pharisees are actually separating themselves from the work and presence of God among them. So the parable of the prodigal sons is really about these two prodigals, right? We've got the sinners, who are corresponding to the younger son, and then we have the Pharisees correspond to the elder son in the parable. So this will be our plan going forward. First, we're going to look at the parable with a focus on the younger son, the younger prodigal. So the word prodigal means, anybody? It's a word we know mostly from this parable, yeah. But it means
excessive.
Yeah, excessive, wasteful. So what we're seeing in this story is this younger son being excessive, wasting himself, wasting his relationship, wasting his inheritance. And then we're going to look at how he does this in two ways. He does it by becoming deaf to his father, to the voice of his father's love. And he also does it by searching for love where it can't be found. Okay, and then after that we're going to look through the story again, but then through the lens of the elder son. And we'll see he actually does the exact same thing. He also wastes his relationship with his father, he wastes his inheritance, and he wastes himself, and he does it in the same way. He becomes deaf to his father's love, and he searches for love in a way that it can't be found. So let's begin in verse 11, if you have your scriptures with you. So Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them." So Luke is very matter-of-fact here. We read those verses and they seem pretty meh. But in a first century context, this would have been unheard of. The younger son's request would have been about the most offensive thing he could have ever asked of his father. And why? Because to ask for the inheritance of your father while your father is still living is tantamount to wishing that your father is dead. So at this point, we're expecting, as readers, the father is going to discipline the son. But instead, we read, "So he divided up his inheritance between them." Stunning. The father's compliance to the younger son's scandalous request would have broken all social conventions, and it would have also broken the father's heart. In verse 13, "Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living," or prodigal living. I don't know about you, but I sometimes struggle to see myself in this kind of defiant rebellion of the prodigal son. You know, this is the story for the drug addicts who come to Jesus, and it's this amazing testimony, right? Well, Henry Nouwen gives us a bit of a different perspective. He says that leaving home is not this blatant, dramatic turning away from God. It can be something a lot more subtle. It can be about denying the spiritual reality that we belong to God. That with every part of our being, God holds us safe in his loving embrace. Home is where we hear God's voice that says to us, "You are my beloved." It's the same voice that gave life to first Adam and spoke to Jesus, the second Adam, at his baptism. It's that voice that we also hear. It's the voice that we hear that sets us free to live with love. When we hear that never interrupted voice of love speaking from all eternity, we know that we're loved. Well, then we can walk through the valley of the shadow of death. We can comfort, we can console, we can encourage without the fear of rejection or the need for affirmation from others. We know that we're loved, and we're free to give life and free also to die. According to Nouwen, the younger son provides us with a self-portrait because we have all become deaf to that voice. We are like the prodigal son when we listen to the voices that say, "Go out into the world and prove that you are worthy of love." These voices loudly deny the voice of our father that love is a totally free gift. They say things like, "How are your grades? What are your connections? Show me that you're a good boy or a good girl. Don't show your weakness or you'll be used. Or have you made all the arrangements for your old age?" As long as we remain in touch with the voice that calls us beloved, these voices are quite innocent and harmless. However, when we forget the voice of that first unconditional love, these innocent voices can start to dominate our lives and pull us into a distant country, away from home, where we eventually become deaf to God's voice of love. We are also like the younger prodigal when we search for love where it cannot be found. If home is the place where we hear God's voice that says, "You're my beloved," leaving home is living as though we don't yet have a home, and that we must search far and wide to find one. Searching for love where it cannot be found means moving away from that home and entering into the world's competition for conditional love. In that competition in the world, there are all these ifs. You'll be loved if you're good looking. You'll be loved if you're intelligent, wealthy, impressive, etc. You and I are the prodigal son when we search for God's unconditional love in this world that can only offer us competitive and conditional love. We are also like the prodigal son when we squander the gifts that God has given us, our health, our money, our intellectual and emotional gifts, and keep using them to impress people, receive affirmation and praise, and compete for rewards. Instead of developing our gifts for the glory of God, we carry them off to a distant country and put them in the service of an exploiting world that does not know their true value. In this way, we are just like the nation of Israel in that parable from Ezekiel that we read. We use the beauty and splendor that God has given us to prostitute ourselves. So in our deafness to the voice of love, in our search for love and worth where it can't be found, and in our squandering of God's gifts, we are like the prodigal son. The younger son's rebellion in this parable reflects Adam's original rebellion and humanity's ongoing rebellion against God, in whose love we are created and by whose love we are sustained. It's the same rebellion that leads you and I to hire ourselves out in a distant country, away from home. So, verse 14. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his field to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. It doesn't take long before the younger son's habit of squandering wealth and living wildly catches up with him. At some point, he realizes he's in trouble. He is not as self-sufficient or as independent as he thought. He begins to be in need. The story reaches its lowest point when the younger son, who had asked for his father's inheritance and received it, now asks for the food that the pigs are eating and does not receive it. Verse 17. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So he got up and went to his father. His lowest point, though, becomes his turning point. When the younger prodigal finds himself desiring to be treated as one of the pigs, he realizes he's not a pig. He's a human being. He's a son of his father. That realization becomes the basis for his choice to live instead of to die. Nevertheless, it's only the beginning. It's only the beginning of his journey back to the father. Although the younger son realizes that his true identity as a son, he has been deeply shaped by his experience in the world. He still cannot grasp the notion of his father's unconditional love. So he makes plans to hire himself out to the father, just as he hired himself out to others. He still sees himself as a servant, not as a son. So he wants to return to the father, but he believes the father to whom he's returning will be harsh and judgmental. He prepares a groveling speech with the hopes that he'll receive minimal punishment and be allowed to survive on the condition of hard labor as a servant. He's traveling home in the right direction, but while he walks, he is full of doubts about whether he'll be truly welcomed home. His fatiguing trip home is full of guilt about his past and full of worries about his future. So what about us? When we think of God's forgiveness, is it a total forgiveness? And what about us? When we return to God, do we see it as a joyful homecoming or as a bargain for survival? As long as we resist God's total forgiveness, we're left with residual shame and guilt in our lives. We end up with partial solutions, like becoming a hired servant. And there are benefits to being God's hired servants, right? As God's hired servants, we can still kind of keep our distance from God. We can still revolt, reject, strike, or complain about our pay. But as God's beloved sons and daughters, we claim our full dignity, and we're restored to full responsibilities as children and heirs of God. This parable gives us, I think, one of the most powerful images in the Bible of God's total forgiveness. We'll spend a lot more time next month on that image, but for now, I'll just read through the next part of the parable without comment, and we'll conclude our reflections on the younger son. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. Before we move on to the next part of the parable, I just want to take a little break and want you to reflect. How are you like the younger son, the younger prodigal? What would it mean for you to hear the voice of divine love and to stop listening to the voice of conditional love? What would it mean for you to search for love where it can be found, and to stop searching where it cannot be found? So verse 25. We get to part two, or act two of the story now. This is about the elder son. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." Verse 28. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. Verse 29. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I have been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." This is where I think the benefit of listening to this parable as a drama might be better. We'd have some emotion in those words, right? And those words are full of emotion. Although we normally think of this parable as a happy story with a literal rags-to-riches ending, it's a wrong impression entirely. The story is not a happy story. It doesn't end with the happy return of the younger prodigal son. There is still an elder son who is very much a part of this story. And for the rest of the time, we're going to focus on this elder son. It's not. In other words, it's not a Disney story. Right? The first reference to the elder son in this story is hidden in the pronoun in verse 2, them. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. So I've already mentioned how scandalous the younger son's request was to the father. It would have broken all social conventions. And you can only imagine how the elder son reacted to that, to those indignities. I'm guessing he berated his younger brother, just ripped into him. And I'm guessing, too, he pleaded with his father not to consent to his younger brother's request. We don't know exactly what happened, but what's clear is that the elder son never forgot what happened. For years, he will live with this bitterness of this memory. On the outside, he did all the things a good son is supposed to do. And in many ways, he is a kind of model older son. On the inside, however, he becomes increasingly unhappy and unfree. When the elder son does finally speak to his father, his words come from a place of deep and hardened hurt. The elder son may have never left home like the younger son, but he has grown just as distant from the father. Even while remaining in his father's house and working on his father's field, he's become estranged. And the extent of that estrangement becomes clear when the elder son is unable to enter into his father's joy. So in verse 25, we read, "Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on." Notice he doesn't go directly into the party. He doesn't ask his father what's going on. He asks a servant. "What's going on? Someone didn't tell me. Why am I being excluded?" The elder son is not ready for joy, but he is ready to be slighted. He's ready to see in the joy of others an intentional exclusion. Verse 27, the unsuspecting servant, full of excitement, eager to share the good news, explains, "Your brother's come back. Your father's killed the fat. He's back home, safe and sound." Right? You can just imagine the servant delivering the good news. But then, what's the next verse? Just like, boom. The older son became angry, refused to enter. The shout of joy can't be received. In fact, the joy summons the elder brother's anger. The music and dancing, instead of inviting to joy, becomes a cause for even greater withdrawal. So his father went out and pleaded with him, which is, of course, what the father always does. He goes out and pleads. And then verse 29, the elder son's response. "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. Look at me. Notice me. This isn't fair. Why aren't you giving me something?" Right? These are the words of complaint from a heart that feels and never received what it was due. They are the words of a complaint that cries out, "I tried so hard and worked so long, I did so much, and still I have not received what others are given so easily. Why am I not appreciated, thanked, and invited, while others who take life so easily and casually get so much attention?" Can you relate to that? I think we can all relate to that. When you read the elder prodigal's words, it's clear how lost he is in his own self-imposed suffering. The words are dripping with self-righteousness, self-pity, jealousy. And yet, his lostness, his prodigalness, is much harder to identify than the lostness of the prodigal younger, wasteful, lustful, dramatic younger son. Right? It's a kind of hidden lostness. It's an inner lostness that happened gradually to this elder son. I think it's also harder to identify the lostness of this elder son because his resentment is so tied up with his desire to be good, to be a good son. So many of us, I think, find our sense of goodness and superiority by comparing ourselves with younger prodigals. Right? We prop up this sense of superiority based on the fact that at least I never did that. At least I'm not like him. But when being good, when it doesn't reward us with the good life we assumed it would, we get angry at God and we get angry at the undeserving younger prodigals. Like the elder prodigal, we see our life of morality, obedience, and service as a burden. We resent it, but we also take pride in it because it gives us the sense of superiority. We secretly wish that we could be indulgent like the younger son, and we express our frustration through this lofty judgmentalism against the younger son. With the words, "this son of yours," the elder son places himself above the younger son. And at the same time, he creates a distance between himself and his father. Right? "This son of yours," not my brother, "this son of yours." He looks at the two of them as aliens who have lost all sense of reality and engaged in a relationship that is completely inappropriate considering the true facts of the prodigal son's life. The father celebrates the return of the son who is dead but is alive again. But for the elder prodigal, his younger brother may as well be dead. The elder son no longer has a brother, nor any longer, it looks like, a father. Both have become strangers to him, and he has become a foreigner in his own house. He can't enter the celebration in his own home. True communion and relationship is gone. The elder son's resentment not only robs him of that relationship with his father and his brother, but it also robs him of his sense of sonship. And we'll see that in his speech. He says, "All these years I've been slaving for you, but never disobeyed your orders." So his sense of superiority, of being a better son, actually robs him of the joy of sonship entirely. He doesn't see himself as a son anymore. He sees himself as a slave. And his language, it's not familial, it's contractual. As if the father owed him his inheritance, and that he earned his inheritance through his hard work. In fact, he sees his inheritance not as the gift of a father to a son, but kind of like a worker's wage, the payment of an employer to an employee. Right? "I never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me an even young goat. Contractually, you owed me this. I did this, you did that." That's how he's thinking. And unfortunately, like I said, it's not a happy ending to this story. These are the last words we hear from the elder son. Thankfully, they're not the last words of the parable. The father gets the last word. And the father's last words are the words, the voice of unconditional love. Right? He goes out and pleads with the son. He says, "My son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." Did the elder son learn the truth of his father's words? Maybe. More likely, I think his father's words would have rung hollow. "What do you mean you're always with me? You've betrayed me by celebrating with that son of yours and wasting the fattened calf. If you were with me, then you wouldn't be participating in that celebration. And what do you mean, my brother? He disowned the family. He's not my brother. He can be a son of yours, but he will not be my brother. And what do you mean, everything you have is mine? You've never given me so much as a young goat to celebrate with my friends. And what do you mean we had to celebrate? I'll tell you what we had to do. We had to discipline and punish this son of yours, and we didn't. And now look what happened to him. And now look, you continue to spoil him." I'm guessing how the conversation went. There's tension, right? There's tension in this story, all the way to the end and through the end. How long does the father continue to plead? Does the elder brother listen and eventually join the celebration? Is the younger son welcomed home by his elder brother? And then maybe if he's welcomed, is it kind of like a half welcome? And then do they live with suspicion and resentment for the rest of their lives together? Does the younger son go on to live with residual shame and guilt? Well, and then when the father dies, what happens? They have the whole inheritance dispute again? Right? How are the younger son, the elder and the younger son, going to resolve that when the father dies? It's going to bring up all the same wounds again, right? Of course, there are no answers to these questions, but I think it's appropriate to ask them. It helps us to kind of enter into the story. And I think Jesus intentionally ends the parable without resolution, because the resolution depends on our response. We are the characters in the story. The Father is our Father. And our Father says to us, "You are always with me." But as long as we remain bitter and withdrawn from God's invitation into joy, we'll not experience the words of truth, the words of our Father. Our Father says, "Everything I have is yours." But as long as we misunderstand the Father's love as conditional and contractual, as if God owes us something for our service to Him, we will forever be fixated on the things God has not given us, and we'll be unable to have appreciation for the things God has given us. Our Father says, "Your brother." But as long as we hold on to a self-righteous sense of superiority over others, we'll be estranged from relationship. Jesus told this parable in order to invite his listeners into God's kingdom celebration. So what about us? Will we accept his invitation and listen to the voice of divine unconditional love that's calling us home? Regardless of whether we are like the younger prodigal or the elder prodigal, our Heavenly Father is waiting to receive us home. And I think if as you heard this story, you start to think about yourself more like the younger son, your challenge is to accept God's total forgiveness. The voice of shame constantly will tell you that you don't belong, that you're phony, that the best you could ever hope to be in God's house is a hired servant. However, by embracing God's total forgiveness, you are given a new birth, a new start, and a new identity. You become a son or daughter. So if you think of yourself more like that younger son, that's your challenge, to accept God's total forgiveness. Not see yourself as a servant, somebody with shame, see yourself as a son and daughter. Full dignity, full responsibilities. And then if you see yourself more in that elder prodigal in the story, I think your challenge is to let go of resentment through gratitude. The voice of resentment will always tell you that you didn't get and you don't get what you deserve. And when you listen to that voice, it leaves you like the elder brother, rivalrous and joyless. However, by embracing gratitude, you claim the truth that all of life is gift and inheritance, not works and wages. By consciously choosing gratitude, even when you are feeling resentful, it won't take long before you find yourself enjoying yourself at the celebration of God's unconditional love. So may God help us all to find our seat at God's table, to find our way home. Amen.